Okay, so let's get started here. So quick reminder that there is a programming assignment out due next week, and if you are going to form a group to work on this assignment, you should let us know who your group members are, okay, so that we can track who is part of what group and make sure we can do the grading accordingly. Okay. Thus far, I think only a very few of you have actually sent email to either me or the TA with your group information. If you are planning to work on in this assignment individually, that's fine. But if you are planning to work in groups, please email. Okay. That's one thing. There is going to be a review homework out soon, later today. Okay. And we'll probably, the TA will talk a little bit about it tomorrow, just to make sure you are all keeping up with the reading. Okay, so we had two lectures. We did a overview of computer architecture. So quick review of basic concepts in architecture. That's what the homework will focus on. So keep an eye out for that. Okay. So what I will do today is give a very broad brush introduction to operating system and its various components. Okay, but before that, let me just quickly recap what we discussed last time. So this picture essentially summarizes what we discussed as far as computer architecture basic concepts go in one slide. Okay, so I said any machine has several components. The processor on the machine, okay, could be one or more cores depending on what kind of machine you have. The main memory on your machine, okay, and all of the I/O peripherals. Okay, and each machine will have several, everything from a disk controller to a USB bus controller to the graphics card and the network card. Okay, and all of these components are interconnected by the system bus. Okay, that's the medium that each component uses to communicate with something else. Okay, we discussed several OS services. Okay, and I said that basically the implementation of these services depends on certain support from the hardware. Okay? And the goal really was to understand what are all these hardware features that any machine provides, and then what can the OS do with it. Okay? So we said to do protection, you need user mode and kernel mode. You have protected instructions that can be only executed in kernel mode. Applications run in user mode. And whenever they want to do any privileged operation, you essentially invoke a system call which traps to the kernel mode. We talked about base and limit registers to protect applications from one another, to ensure that a process, one process, cannot access the memory that has been allocated to some other process. Okay? We discussed the notion of interrupt and how interrupt vectors are used in order to jump to the right interrupt service routine. I mentioned system calls. I'll have more to say about this today. We talked about I/O and how you have different types of I/O, interrupt based I/O, memory mapped I/O, synchronous I/O, which is blocking I/O, and asynchronous I/O, which is a non-blocking version of I/O. Okay, we talked about timers and how that can be used to do CPU scheduling and accounting. I briefly mentioned atomic instructions. Okay, we'll again come back to this when we have an entire chapter on synchronization. So at that point, we are going to revisit this notion of atomic instructions. And I mentioned virtual memory, okay, which is an abstraction that allows your OS to essentially give you the illusion of having infinite memory, okay, so that the all the processes that you are currently running on your machine have a total size that exceeds the size of RAM, and yet you can run all of these processes. Okay. So those are some of the hardware features that you at least need to be aware of. We will revisit them in more detail as we talk about all of these OS services in throughout the course. Okay, are there any questions on this before I start today's lecture? Anything at all that needs clarifications? Okay. So this is the agenda for today. So what we will do is now look at the OS, the kernel, in more detail. Okay, so today's class is going to be what are the key components of any OS kernel. Okay, and then there are several. Okay, everything from the component that manages processes to the OS component that deals with synchronization to memory management, file and I/O systems, and distributed systems. So we'll look at each of these pieces in a little more detail. Okay, as I had already mentioned in the first class, These are the key components of the course itself. Okay, so after today's introduction, we'll take each of this in turn and then spend several classes discussing. Okay, so this is just a high level introduction to what is the architecture of a kernel, what are the key components, what do these components do. Okay, and then I'll talk about architectural organizations of any OS kernel, which ranges all the way from monolithic kernels to modular kernels. So this is how architecturally the code is structured. This is what the code of a kernel actually does for you. Okay, so let's start with that and then we'll end with the OS organization. Okay, so let's take each of them in turn. So this is the same picture I put up last time, okay, with one more column. Okay, so here on one hand we have the hardware abstraction. Okay, what is the key components of the hardware? These are the OS services you provide, and this is what the user actually sees. Okay? So let's look at each in turn. So you have the processor on your machine. Okay? As far as OS services go, you do process management, scheduling, traps, protection, synchronization. Okay? This is what we will actually study, okay, in this course. Okay? This is what you as the user actually sees. Okay? So you actually see the notion of processes and threads, really. Okay, you can start up new application, they start up as processes with multiple threads. Okay? And this is what the OS does to enable or implement that abstraction. Okay? You have memory on your machine. Okay? The OS services that you get are memory management, virtual memory, protection, and so on. And what the user abstraction that you see are that of address space. Okay? Each process that you each program that you write can essentially only access its own memory. Okay, and nothing else. So that's the address space of that process. Okay. Your I/O devices. Okay. OS services include concurrent processing of I/O and CPU, handling of interrupts, and so on. And what the user actually sees are all of the devices and that are connected to the machine, and how you interact with those devices. Everything from terminal to mice, keyboards, printers, USB devices, and so on. Okay. In your file systems, okay, essentially this is the disk on your system and the file system. What the OS allows you to do is file management. Okay, it's create files, delete files, organize them in folders and whatnot. Okay, and then you essentially see this notion of files and directories. You don't have to deal with the low-level details of what the disk looks like, where on disk your data is stored, and so on. The OS is going to deal with that. Okay. The last one is that of a distributed system. OS services include support for networking. Okay, support for security, distributed file systems, remote access, and so on. And the way you implement this at application level are through network file system, socket communication, and remote procedure calls. So this is basically also gives you a quick look at the organization of an operating system. These are the key components that I talked about on the previous slide. Okay. This is what the user will actually see. This is the abstraction that the user sees, and this is the hardware feature that is used to implement that service. Okay. So let's start with the first one, which is a process. Okay. So as you know, OS will manage a number of activities for users. Okay. These are running user programs. Any application that you start up, you may have bad jobs, you may be running scripts. So you have to run all of that, and there may be system level program. There may be daemons and background processes that do everything, that provide file services, print services, web services, and whatnot. Okay? All of these activities are encapsulated using an abstraction called a process. Okay? So a process, the definition of a process is essentially that it's a program in execution. Okay? A process is distinct from a program. A program is essentially code that you write, and the machine code that your compiler spits out that you have on disk. Okay, that's a program. When you start executing that program, you get what is called a process. Okay, this is basically a program that is in execution. Okay, so it is one instance of a program in execution. There may be many processes that may be running many different programs. Okay, there may also be many processes that are running the same different instances of the same program. You could start the same program multiple times, you will get multiple processes. And processes tend to be independent entities. Okay? So what is a process, a program in execution? It's essentially the memory contents of a program. It's the execution contents, which includes the memory that has been allocated to the program, the code that has been loaded in memory, the data that has been allocated. Okay? All the state of the registers, the state of the program counters, and the resources that is process is accessing, which could be files and so on. Okay? That is what a process contains. Okay? So the definition of a process is it's a program in execution, and what it contains is basically the memory state of that program, okay, as well as the register state and all of the resources it is accessing. Okay? Is this clear? What's a process? Okay? We will come back to this definition and actually look at how processes are created and deleted and what they contain in more detail. Okay? But this is just the high level definition of what a process is. So as far as the OS is concerned, it gives you several abstraction that allows you to create new processes, delete processes, suspend them, resume them, and so on. Okay? At a user level, you don't really deal with this. Okay? All you probably do is you may double click on an icon. Okay? As far as the OS is concerned, that signals to the OS that it has to actually load this program and start execution, which means it will create a process. Okay. Occasionally you may have actually deleted a process. Okay, if you quit any application, the process deletes itself. But if your process hangs, you may actually go and delete the process. Okay, so the OS provides all of this facility to do process management. Okay, and we'll come back to how you do this. Okay, it also schedules and manages processes. Okay, there may be multiple processes on any machine. Okay, and the OS has to decide in what order to run them, how much CPU time to give to each of them, and so on. Okay. So in other words, it does scheduling of processes on the processors. Okay. It also manages inter-process communication. There will be many processes that need to communicate with one another to achieve some goal. Okay. The operating system provides facilities for processes to communicate with one another. Okay. It also deals with synchronization. Well, let's have more to say about that on the next slide. And last but not least, it allocates resources to processes. It decides, I said, how much CPU time to give, how much memory to allocate, and so on and so forth. Okay. Just to give you a quick example, let's just look at this machine, for instance. And here is a listing of all of the processes that are running on this machine. Okay, you'll see that there is Firefox there, there's a mail application, there's Safari. That's the process ID. These are all the processes that are currently running. That tells you who the user is that started that process. Okay, that it also, that this column actually tells you how much CPU time is currently being allocated. You'll see that is something, I think that is this process itself is taking 5% of the CPU. Okay. Then there are other columns that tell you how much memory has been allocated and how much virtual memory has been allocated. I'll come back to this when we talk about memory in a couple of slides. Okay. So this just shows you all of the processes. Whenever you double click on an icon, it will start a new process. So just to give you an example, let's see. Okay, so that is a browser. Okay, so that's Google's Chrome browser. And you'll see that I actually started two processes there. There's a helper process called Google Chrome Helper, and there's the browser itself. Okay? And I was talking about synchronization and inter-process communication. So these are two processes that collectively implement this browser application. Okay? And they have to communicate with one another to do whatever the user tells it to do. Okay? So the OS actually allows this inter-process communication, which allows the helper process to work with the browser process to do something. So that's just an example of two processes why they have to communicate with one another. Okay. We will also see that there is something called threads. We will come back to that when we do the process chapter. Okay. These are multiple execution contexts within the same process. Okay. That's what a thread is. Okay. So let's go back to the lecture. Okay, so now let's talk about synchronization. Okay, what does synchronization mean? So whenever processes coordinate with one another to do something, okay, they have to use a feature called synchronization, which enables this coordination. Synchronization, very simply, is a feature that allows different processes to coordinate their activities. Okay, so they can synchronize with one another. So why do you need this? Let's take some examples from the real world. Okay, let's assume that there's a bank that's implementing a set of processes. Okay, so there may be a ATM machine that is trying to access. When you walk to an ATM machine and try to withdraw cash, for instance, there's a process there that tries to access your bank records. Okay, there may be other processes that the bank runs for instance, to compute balances on your account, to add monthly interest. If your bank is generous enough to give you interest, then you can probably so there are all these processes that are accessing this bank record. Okay? Now, if these processes don't coordinate with one another when they do this activity, bad things can happen. Okay, so let's just take a very simple example of, let's say that you have $100 in your checking account. Okay, and there's an ATM process that's trying to, let's say, deduct some money, and then there is a there's an interest computation process that's trying to add something to this checking account. Okay. Now, what each of these processes do is they have to read this record, okay? They have to compute something, and then they have to update that record. Okay. So, for instance, if you say I want to withdraw $25, okay, this process has to first go and check whether you have that much money in your checking account. Okay. If the answer is yes, then it will actually dispense some cash to you, and then it will go and update this record by subtracting $25 from it. Okay. Similarly, this interest computation process is first going to have to read your balance, okay, and then it has to compute some interest, okay, based on the balance. Let's say you get 1% interest, it has to compute a fraction of that, and then it has to go back and add to it. Okay. So each of these processes is doing multiple things to this account balance, which is reading, is doing some computation, and is doing writing. Now, if it so happens, so in these activities, if these processes are running concurrently, okay, these activities will get interleaved with one another. The read and the write of different processes get interleaved. And if you do not coordinate this well, okay, then you might end up with unintended results here. Okay. I will not talk about why that is the case right now. I'm just giving a very high level example of why you might need to coordinate. Okay. But if the point is, you want to make sure that this account balance is what it should be. You don't want some bogus result here because something bad happened. Okay? So the feature that the operating system provides to do this is called synchronization. It provides this feature called locks, monitors, mutual exclusion to allow you to access whenever you have shared variables. So here this becomes a shared variable. Whenever you have shared data or shared variable that multiple processes are accessing, okay, you use this notion of locks or other techniques of synchronization to ensure that the end results are consistent, okay, and correct. Okay. That's basically what synchronization is. We will come back to this and I will have more detailed examples to give you of where you use these techniques of synchronization when we come back to the notion of locks and mutexes. So at this point, all you need to know is that synchronization is a method that allows multiple processes to coordinate their activity. Okay, so that's just really a high level notion of what synchronization is. Okay, so now let's move on to memory and secondary storage management. Okay, so you know what main memory is. Main memory is basically essentially a direct access storage medium for the CPU. This is where the program code is loaded. This is where the program stores its data. And what the CPU does is it fetches instructions from main memory, it executes them, and it updates the data for this process. Okay. So what the OS essentially does to make this happen is it has to allocate, whenever you start a new process, it has to allocate some piece of RAM for that process. Okay. Whenever a process terminates, it has to deallocate memory. Okay. It has to keep track of which regions of memory are in use and which regions of memory are free. What pages are allocated, which ones are free. Okay. It has to maintain mappings from what is called virtual memory to physical memory. Okay. What processes essentially see is an abstraction called virtual memory. Okay. I already said that essentially the OS gives you an illusion of infinite memory. Okay. Although you have a limited amount of RAM on your machine, processes don't have to deal with that limit. The operating system essentially allows you to use as much memory as you want, and it figures out which parts of the process to keep in RAM and which ones to keep on disk. Okay. To do this, it has to maintain several mappings. Okay. There is a notion of virtual memory and there is a notion of physical memory. And the mapping between the two is a data structure called a page table. Okay. So it has to keep track of page tables for each processes. Okay. And it has to decide how much memory to allocate to a process. Okay. Okay. Again, we will come back to all of this. This will probably be 7 or 8 lectures of this class. We'll come back to allocation and deallocation of memory, the notion of virtual memory, page tables, and so on. Okay. At this point, all you need to know is the operating system deals with memory management. Okay. So let's go back to that example I was showing you of all the processes. You can actually see how much memory has been allocated to various processes. Okay. So let me actually blow this up a little bit. So you will see that there are 2 columns here for every process. This one is real memory. Okay, that's what it says. So that's how much physical memory is currently allocated to that process. And this one says virtual memory. Okay. That says how much memory does the process think it actually has. Okay. Although the OS has actually given it much less. So you will see that there are cases where here is a process. This is actually the Safari browser. It thinks it has 400 megabytes, 394 megabytes of RAM. But what has actually been allocated is only 205. Okay. So the rest of that process is currently stored on disk. Okay. As the process executes and it touches these other parts of the process, the OS will actually dynamically fetch the parts that are on disk into RAM and then take some parts that are in RAM and put them back on disk. Okay. So it does all of this management for you. Okay. So if you actually add up all of the RAM that you have allocated to all processes, you will see that this frequently exceeds the size of physical memory. Okay, that's to add up the virtual memory that's been allocated to all the process. That's going to be more than, that's not all the processes on the machine, there are several more. Okay, so if you add up this column, it will exceed the 2 gig that I have on this machine. Okay, and so basically what this is showing you, the hard processes that collectively need more than 2 gig, yet I have only 2 gig of RAM. Okay, and the OS is managing this for me by figuring out which parts of processes to keep in RAM and which ones to keep on disk. Okay, this is essentially what virtual memory does for you. Any questions here? Okay. And you'll also see that the OS has decided how much RAM to allocate. Okay. It decided that Safari should get 394 meg of RAM. And so there is a reason why it has to figure out this and then make sure the sufficient amount of memory is allocated and so on. And that amount of RAM can grow or shrink over time. Okay, as the process allocates more memory or deallocates what it is doing, that amount of RAM can also fluctuate. I mean, that amount of virtual memory can fluctuate. Okay. The next abstraction that we'll talk about is that of a file system. Okay. So this you should be familiar with, because you basically, if you use any machine, you essentially deal with files, okay, in some shape or form and directories. Okay. Now at a low level, files are stored on some persistent storage medium. Okay. So this is typically the hard disk on your machine, could be your USB thumb drive or a CD-ROM or some device that is persistent. Okay. By persistent we mean if you reboot the machine, data on that medium does not go away. Okay, if you reboot your machine, the files on your disk don't disappear, they stay there. Okay. So typically the file system resides on a persistent storage medium. Okay. And the most common one that you know, deal with are that of a hard disk. Okay. At a low level, hard disk is too crude an abstraction for users to deal with. Okay. So if you think of a CD, it basically has a platter and there's data recorded on it. When you insert that CD in your CD-ROM drive, you don't deal with what files are stored where and all of those low-level details. The OS manages those details for you. What you instead see is this higher-level abstraction of a file system, okay, which is essentially a collection of files. Each file is mapped onto some location on the CD-ROM or a hard disk. Okay. So, essentially the file system provides this higher-level abstraction of logical objects. Okay. And operations on those objects. Operations include opening a file, closing a file, deleting files, creating directories and subdirectories and whatnot. Okay. And I already mentioned a file system is essentially a long-term storage entity, and this is a definition of what a file is. Okay. It's a named collection of persistent information. Okay, that can be read or written. Okay. Every file has a name. Okay. That's why it's called a named collection of data. Okay. And it is persistent, which means it is not going to disappear if your machine reboots. Okay. So this is your formal definition of what a file is. Okay. Any file system that you deal with today, okay, has support for directories which allow you to create subdirectories and whatnot. Okay. Okay? There are lots of different file systems in use today. Okay? If you use Windows, you will have the NTFS file system. Okay? That's the NT file system. If you use Macs, you have HFS file system. Okay? You use Unix, you will have EXT3, EXT4, Riser file system. There are a whole bunch of them that are used in the Unix world. Okay? And then you take some other operating system, let's say Solaris, it has its own file system, ZFS. Okay? So although all of them give you this notion of a file, what is different about all these file systems, okay, whether it's NTFS or EXT3 or whatnot, is what policies they use for how they organize the file on disk. Okay? Different file systems will use different policies on how large a block you use, how you allocate files, how you deallocate files, what internal data structures to use. All of that is going to be different across file system. But at a high level, you don't care. You know, all you need is a notion of the abstraction of a file system that you can use to create your data and access it at a later time. Okay. So we'll come back to, again, file systems is going to be several lectures later on in this slide, in this course. We'll come back to all of this. Okay. So essentially what a file system is giving you is a file management interface, okay, that can create, delete files, directories, and manipulate them. Okay. It also provides a number of other services that you may not necessarily think of, which are backups, okay, accounting information saying who is using how much disk, quotas. So there are systems that allow you to impose a quota which says you can only use X amount of space on this disk. Okay. If you exceed that, then you cannot create any more files. Right. They are rarely imposed these days because disks are so large that you typically don't impose quotas. But there are systems that can allow you to impose a quota on each user. And you have variety of other information about what groups the files belong to, who can access the files, and so on. Okay, security is also part of the file system. So you can set permissions on files so that only certain users can access them and and others cannot. So the OS is essentially providing all of this functionality using the file system management interface. Okay? And what goes with that are the low-level routines that any file system implements. Okay? These low-level routines include how do you manage the disk space. Okay? So if you have, let's say, 100 gig hard drive, okay? Initially the entire disk is free. Okay? There's no data stored on it. As you start creating files, okay, the OS and the file system have to track which disk blocks have been allocated to files, which blocks are free, okay, what blocks belong to which files. So all of these are data structures that the file system has to maintain internally. Okay. And these data structures are used by the OS whenever you start opening a file and creating new files. The data structures have to be updated. Okay. So this is disk space management. And in some cases, okay, so some cases, some of these routines are implemented below the file system layer. Okay, so if you look at an operating system kernel, okay, you might have a file system here. And below these are the device drivers. Here is your hard disk. Okay. So the boundary between what is a file system is often blurry. Okay. Depending on the exact file system you have, some functionality for disk space management or scheduling may be implemented in the file system, and sometimes the functionality is implemented in the device driver. Okay. As far as we are concerned, we will deal with file and storage management as one logical unit in this course. So we will not really worry about where this boundary lies. Anything that deals with the storage space, which includes a file system as well as the low-level routine, we will lump into the file system layer. Okay? So, but keep that in mind that there is actually a division that most operating systems will implement, say this is the file system and these are the low-level routines that are basically that deal with the low-level internals of the disk, okay, which includes scheduling I/O operations to disks, managing disk blocks and whatnot. Okay, are there questions on this? People are blank. Is this clear what I'm saying? This is just a high-level introduction. As I said, each of these slides is going to be several lectures. Okay, so, but this is just to give you an overview of what is in a kernel, so that you now have this big picture, and then we look at each component in more detail. Okay. So now let's look at the I/O system. Okay, this is the fourth component on the system. As I mentioned to you, the I/O subsystem on in a kernel is that part of the kernel that deals with all of the low-level peripherals. Okay. So lot of this is frequently implemented as device drivers. Okay, so because device drivers are that part of the kernel that actually deal with devices. Okay, they tend to be I/O devices. And there are several device drivers that you may have in any OS that includes the one for each peripheral, okay, the terminal and the keyboard and the printer, mouse, the network card and so on. Okay. Typically, most of the I/O subsystem provide some common functionality, and then the device drivers actually deal with the particular device itself. Okay. So one is buffering and spooling of I/O. Whenever you have an I/O command that's reading or writing to a device, typically there's a buffering feature that the OS provides. You either read or write into a buffer, and then that buffer is handed over to the OS or the application. Okay. So buffering and spooling is a general functionality. Okay. And then many devices in certain operating systems provide you a nicer, easier to use interface. Okay. In the Linux kernel, for instance, most devices are exported to you through using a /dev interface. Okay. I don't know if most of you are familiar with it. I can show you an example of how you can use a file system interface to implement a device driver. Okay, so let's look at this is a Linux machine. So if you go into this /dev interface, you will see that there are several devices here. Okay. So here are some USB devices. So they are named USB dev 1. This is RAM. Okay, this is main memory. Okay, and then there are several others. So here is the disk. It's a device. You can go in there and see what's in there. Okay, so here is your CD-ROM on the machine. Okay. So from a user perspective, this looks like a file. Okay, so the file name is /dev/CD-ROM. Okay. You can read or write through this device using a file system interface. But what is happening underneath is whenever you try to access this device, okay, all of these calls are then handed over to the I/O subsystem, which then hands them over to the underlying device driver. Okay. So rather than having an interface on a per device basis, what Linux has chosen to do is that all devices present a file system like abstraction. It looks like this device is a file, but it's not really a file. You can see that there are other devices. There should be a mouse somewhere in there. So these are all the terminals that you have. TTYs are the terminals. There is no mouse connected to it. Maybe it's in input. Yeah, so there is a mouse device here. Okay. So all of these devices show up as files, okay, in the Linux world. Okay, and you can access them through typical file operations, although these are not files. I mean, a mouse is not a file, okay, but you can access it using open and read. So if you read from this device, any mouse click shows up as an event that is passed on using the file interface back to an application. Okay. This is one way of interacting with devices using a already familiar interface. Rather than saying open mice and wait for event, you are just doing a read on the mouse file, okay, on the device file for the mouse. Okay. So that is what I mean by a general purpose device driver interface that hides the differences between device, and it often mimics the file system interface. Okay. So you have this /dev interface in Linux. And then you have to have the device drivers themselves. Okay. And there will be a whole set of them that are specific to each machine. Depending on what devices you have, you need a device driver for each device on your machine. Any questions on this? Is this notion of I/O subsystem clear? Yes? Okay. Okay, so the last component of the course is a distributed system component. So this is basically the networking subsystem within your operating system. Okay, typically in today's world, machines don't exist in isolation. Okay? They sit on a network and they can communicate with other machines. Okay? And the component of the kernel that allows all of that to happen is the distributed systems and the networking component. So first we'll start with an example, the definition of what is a distributed system. Essentially it's a collection of processes, okay, that reside on independent machines, okay, that collectively implement some application. Okay? And there is a more precise definition there which is, says that it's a collection of processes that do not share a memory or a clock. Okay? That's just a different way of saying these are resides on different machines. Okay? They reside on different machines, they will not share either a memory or a clock. Okay. So what are examples of a distributed systems? You probably have used various networked applications. They are all examples of distributed systems. So can you think of some? Cloud computing, that's an example. Can you speak? EdLab system, yes. So it's a collection of machines, but a distributed system is essentially a collection of processors and processes. Okay? So think application, not hardware. Okay? Boink is an example of a distributed system. Any file server is an example of a distributed system, okay? Because there's a file server component and a file client component. Okay? Network printer. Okay, you have a print server and a print client, two processes that are doing something together. The web is an example of a global distributed system. Okay. There are lots of web servers and lots of browsers. Okay. Each is an independent process. Okay. They are communicating with one another. Okay. So practically any system you see today, okay, that uses a network, okay, is an example of a distributed system. Okay, so several were mentioned here, going from cloud computing to specialized access. So anything you do, Skype, Twitter, Facebook, they are all examples of distributed systems because they use multiple processes to implement their functionality. Often it's a browser and a server, but in many cases it's more than that. Okay? So that should tell you what a distributed system is. What we will study here is what should the operating system do internally to allow these processes to communicate with one another. What abstractions to provide so that you can write your own distributed application. Okay, how do you write an application where there are two processes that communicate with one another? Okay. And the abstraction that you get are socket communication, remote procedure calls. Okay, if you use Java, then you use remote method invocation or RMIs. Okay. So there are abstractions like this that allow you to implement these processes. Okay. So the OS not only supports functionality to write your own application, it also allows you to access data or files that are stored on other machines. Okay? This is referred to as a distributed file system. Okay? So in EdLab, for instance, there's EdLab server, which is where your home directory is. Okay? That's where all your files are stored. Okay? You can go to any machine, any workstation, and log in, and your files become available to you when you log in. The way this is done is the operating system implements this notion of a distributed file system, which allows this EdLab workstation to access files that are stored on a server somewhere. Okay? You can do the same thing by creating a network drive in Windows, okay, or mount a network partition from some other machine. Okay? So what the OS is doing in all of these cases is implementing this notion of a file system, which is itself distributed, and that essentially says that the files are scattered across machines, you can access them over a network from some other machine. Okay? A distributed file system is itself an example of a distributed system. Okay? So what we'll see in this class is some examples of distributed file system, such as NFS, okay, or the network file system. It's one of the oldest and a very popular distributed file system. We'll see how NFS works, how can you access files that are stored on other machines and so on, and what the OS implements as far as NFS goes. Okay. So that's the last component of this course. Yeah, so what we are going to do, so this is also a roadmap of how we are going to go proceed. Okay, we'll start with processes and threads, that is going to be the first key component. And once you have understood what processes are, what threads are, we'll talk about synchronization. And you will actually, the real programming assignment that I'll hand out in a few weeks will be on threads and synchronization. Okay, so you will actually implement a program that will use threads, it will use the synchronization feature. Okay, so processes, threads and synchronization is the first component. Okay, then we will move on to memory management. We'll talk about how memory is allocated to processes, what this notion of virtual memory is, and so on. Okay, then we'll come back to the third component, which is files, I/O and storage management. Okay, what are I/O devices in general? Okay, and how disks are an example of an I/O device, how disks are managed, how file systems are implemented. And the last component will be on distributed file system. Okay, so the three programming assignments will be one that will deal with processes, threads and synchronization. One assignment will deal with memory management, and there will be one that will deal with file system. Okay. Although we will talk about distributed file system, there won't be a programming assignment on that. That's going to come far too late in the course to actually do any assignments. Okay. So that's a quick roadmap of not only a sort of what is coming down the road, but also what are operating systems. Okay, so now I'm going to talk again about system calls. I briefly introduced this notion last time, okay, when we were talking about traps. Yeah, I mentioned this user mode and kernel mode and how you switch from user mode to kernel mode. Okay, so let's look at this in a little more detail. Okay, so system call is essentially the programming interface, okay, that is provided by the operating system to all of the services it provides. Okay, typically when you write an application, you don't really program at the level of system calls. You know, typically one level too low for application programmers to write their application. So you actually use higher level interfaces, which are typically the APIs that your programming language provides. Okay, so if you write your application in C or C++, use the C API or the C++ API. If you write your application in Java, you use Java APIs. Okay. And typically these APIs are written as libraries, and those libraries are the ones that are actually making system calls. Okay. You can certainly program at this low level and write your application using system calls, but frequently you don't. Okay. Because libraries provide you higher level interfaces or abstractions that are easier to use than this low level system call interface. Okay. But nevertheless, any application you write essentially communicates with the operating system using system calls. Okay, typically, it's indirect communication. You call a function, that function goes to the library makes the system call, okay, rather than you directly making the system call. Okay. And there are several APIs that are in use. Okay, in Windows, you have the Win32 API. On most Unix-like systems, you have POSIX APIs. In Java, you have the Java API, okay, that the JVM implements. Okay. So there's a question here saying, why program at the level of APIs rather than programming at the level of system call? Okay? I already answered this question, because this is more convenient than using this low-level interface. Okay? So you basically have libraries that provide you even better interfaces and abstractions, more powerful interfaces that themselves make use of system calls, okay, that are implemented using system calls. Okay? So the thing to keep in mind is you are any application you write, any program you write is actually using system calls underneath. Okay, but you are not programming at that level of abstraction, you are programming at a higher level. Okay, so here's an example of a Win32 call. This is a read file. Okay, so this is the name and these are the argument. Okay, we will not go into the details of what this function does. The only thing I want to mention is this call itself is implemented using some system call. Okay, this is a library function. Okay, it's a library wrapper, and the library then, when you call read file, okay, this is a call that reads the file, as you can imagine, will then use the Windows system call to actually read that file from the file system. Okay, here is another example, okay, of a C function in the Unix world. Okay, so if you actually use printf to print something on the screen, okay, so this is what you use in your program. In Java you could use print line or something equivalent. Okay, so this is going to print a string on your terminal. Okay, and this is what your C API gives you. This printf itself will then use a system call, which is a write, and it will write something to your terminal or your screen. सकते हैं. सो दैट्स द लाइब्रेरी. द सी लाइब्रेरी विल देन यूज द सिस्टम कॉल्ड इम्प्लीमेंट दैट फंक्शन. देयर आर जस्ट टू एग्जांपल्स टू शो यू. सो एज यू कैन सी हियर दिस प्रिंट ऑफ गोज टू द स्टैंडर्ड सी लाइब्रेरी. सी लाइब्रेरी यूजेज द राइट सिस्टम कॉल. यू कूड हैव ऑफकोर्स डायरेक्टली यूज राइट बट देन यू आर प्रोग्रामिंग एट अ मच लोअर लेवल ऑफ एब्स्ट्रैक्शन. So, some details of how system calls are actually implemented. So, any operating system will have dozens of system calls that provide various different functionality. Okay, I showed you a list last time. Here is another one. Okay, that just shows you several. Okay, this is the Windows world and that's the Unix world. Okay, so there are system calls to do process control, system calls to do file manipulation, device manipulation, just to get some information. Communication and security. Okay, so there you can create, delete processes. In the file system, you can create, delete files, create directories. In device manipulation, you can write to console and whatnot. Okay, here you can sleep, you can get the time of the day, you can set timers. In communication, you can use pipes to communicate, and then here you can change permissions on files and so on to get the desired security feature. So each of these are all equivalent. But what this is showing you is just a sampling of the various system calls an operating system provides. Okay, typically, you will have a few hundred system calls in any modern operating system. And the way they are implemented is by associating a number with each system call. Okay, so every system call is internally represented as a number. Okay, so what happens is when you invoke that system call, you create a trap, as I was mentioning last time. Okay. So this trap will then index into this trap vector. Okay. And that number tells is the index into the trap vector, which tells you where the system call is actually implemented in the kernel. That's the memory address that you will jump to, and that's the code in the kernel that will implement that call for you. Okay. This is the reason we essentially have a system call which is implemented as a table, and every system call is an entry with a corresponding number, and then this is implemented as trap vectors, as I was mentioning. Okay. Now, as a user, as a application developer, none of these details are important to you. Okay. These are just the internals of how system calls are implemented. You as an application programmer just program at an even higher level of abstraction, which is at the API level. Okay. But internally, we need to know how system calls are implemented so that you have better understanding of how applications communicate with the OS and vice versa. Okay, so this is just an example of what I just mentioned last time. Here is a user application that's trying to open a file. Okay, that triggers the open system call. Okay, that causes a trap. Okay, this is basically a privileged operation because this accesses a device, some data on disk. As I said last time, applications cannot directly access I/O devices. Okay, so this is going to cause a trap. Okay, so this comes to the system call interface, and then the program's execution of the program is suspended, and the kernel starts executing. So now you are in kernel mode. Okay, you are in privileged mode. So this system call is essentially has a number associated with it. So what the OS does is it basically indexes into this trap vector. Okay. And let's say that is system call I. Okay, let's say it's 10. So then this is a trap vector that has a pointer saying where in the O kernel code is this open call implemented. Okay. So you index into it, and then you actually jump to that part on the kernel and you execute open. Okay, which will actually require you to go access the disk, access the file, open it, create a file descriptor and whatnot. Okay. And then you return once you are done. Okay, at this point, you will go back to the system call interface and then go back to the program. Okay, then you will switch back from kernel mode to user mode. Okay. So that's basically how you go from an API in the application to the system call to the kernel to its implementation. Okay, that's the path of any system. Any questions on this? Is this clear? Okay. Okay, so now there's an issue of how system calls will often have parameters. Okay. So then there's a question of how this user application is going to pass those parameters to the kernel. Okay. Now, it should be clear how what happens if you are invoking a function with some parameters. Okay, so if you make a function call and then you are passing some parameters, how is that, how are those parameters passed to the code of that function? If you call the function foo, you pass an integer I, okay, and here is the code for foo. Okay. How is this passed to the to this function? Typically, when a process executes, okay. So you heard of a stack, right? So typically, that's the part of the program where the parameters of a function are stored. So if you call foo, you create, you push this parameter I onto the stack. Okay, and you jump to that code, this code can then access this parameter I. Okay, this is how a typical program works. Okay, a system call is a special function call, but now you have to pass that parameter to the OS kernel. Okay, OS kernel is a distinct process. It's not the same process. Okay, so you can't just push this parameter onto the stack and then jump to the kernel, because the kernel is a different process from the application. So there has to be a special mechanism for you to pass parameters between the user space and the kernel space. Yeah. So that mechanism is different from what happens when you call a function within the same process. Okay, that you use the stack mechanism to pass those parameters. Here you need a different mechanism. Yeah, so how do you go about doing this? Okay. The simplest case, you will basically use registers. Okay. You will actually place the parameters in registers, and then you will just jump to kernel mode, and the kernel can go and find the parameters in registers. That's one way by which you can actually pass parameters. Okay? This is only going to work if your parameters are limited in size and number. If your parameter is a string, you typically cannot put that in a register. Okay? Because registers are of limited size. Okay? So this will only work if you are passing simple parameters. If you are doing something more complicated, then you have to store it in a block in memory. Okay, so you actually put these parameters in a memory block. Okay, you jump to the kernel and provide the kernel with the address of that block, saying I kept all of the parameters at this memory page, go and access it from there. Okay, so this is typically when the address of the block is passed as a parameter in the register. So this is typically what happens in Linux and Solaris. You put all the parameters in some memory region, take the address of that memory region, you put it in the register, you jump to the kernel mode. Okay, so the address has been passed as the register. In the register, you go and access that region of memory, you copy those parameters out. Okay, so that's typically how you do it. Okay, this you will typically not do. Okay, this you will only do in certain operating systems where the distinction between a process address space and the kernel address space is blurry. In this case, you can push something onto the stack and have the OS pop it. But typically, you keep these address spaces distinct, so this is typically not used. Okay, you would either use registers or you would use blocks as a way to pass parameters for system calls. Okay? So the thing to keep in mind is passing parameters in a system call is different from passing parameters in a function call. A function call, you will use the stack. In a system call, you are giving these parameters to a kernel, which is a completely different process. Okay, as far as the OS, as the system is concerned, the kernel address space and the process address space are two different parts of memory. Okay, so you will have to use other mechanisms to pass parameters back and forth. And same would be true for passing return values. Okay, in a function call, you will put the return value on the stack, okay, and you will return back to the function. You cannot do that here. You have to either use registers or put the return value in the block and go back to the process. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so that's all I have to say about system calls. Okay, so here is a picture that sort of summarizes one architecture, so of the kernel. Okay, so again, to define what a kernel is, okay, so it's a protected part of the OS that runs in kernel mode. It maintains critical OS data structures and it protects these data structures from user program. Okay, now typically, what is a kernel and what are user processes, is debatable. It depends on the operating system. We will see in a couple of slides examples of systems where key components that you normally expect to reside in the kernel are implemented as user processes. Okay. And we'll see other kernels where everything is actually contained within one process, okay, which is the kernel process. Okay. So there's still a debate about what actually is in the kernel and what is the part of the OS, okay, that is outside the kernel. Okay. The kernel is the key component, is the core of the OS. Okay. But not everything that the OS does has to be in the kernel. Some parts of it can be outside the kernel. Okay. So what's the boundary of an operating system kernel and what's the boundary of the operating system itself may not be the same thing. It depends on the specific system we are going to look at. Okay. So this picture just shows you the organization of the Unix-like kernel. Okay. At the lowest level, you have device drivers. Okay. These are the components that talk to devices. This is the main part of the kernel. This is the core of the kernel that has everything from the file system to process management to memory management, all the components that we have been talking about. Okay. Here you have basically the system called interface. Okay. And everything about this is applications and users. So that include processes, shells, scripts, anything else that runs in user space. Okay. So this, everything below this is kernel and everything above this is the application or user space. This is the picture that is true for Unix. That's not necessarily the picture that's true for every platform. We'll see some other organizations. Okay. Now this picture is also referred to as a monolithic kernel. Okay. The reason it's called a monolithic kernel is all the code for the kernel actually is one big privileged process that runs on your machine. Okay. So the kernel is one large entity that runs and all of the functionality is within this one entity. Okay. Now as you can imagine, the monolithic kernels are not very easy to write and maintain. Because this is one large process, all of these components are within one entity. Anytime you change one component here, okay, it might have unintended consequences on some other components. Okay. So when you design any large software system, okay, you typically don't write it as one large blob of process. Okay, you have components in there, you try to separate the components, you provide interfaces to components and so on. Okay. So this organization has evolved into other organizations that are more modular, easier to maintain from a software engineering perspective. Okay, so there are several such organizations we'll talk about here. Okay, the first one is layered organization. Okay. So here your operating system kernel is implemented as a set of layers. Okay. Each layer implements a certain functionality. Okay, so here you see there is the CPU scheduler layer and there's the IO channel and a virtual memory and the device drivers and whatnot. Okay. So what happens in a layered organization is that each layer uses the features provided by the layer below it. You add a certain functionality and you export some other functionality to the layer above it. Okay. And then the next layer then uses that features, adds some other functionality and exports yet another set of abstractions to the layer above it. Okay. So, and the other thing here is that each layer can only talk to the layer below it and the layer above it. Okay, so in this organization, this is a hypothetical organization, the CPU scheduler cannot directly talk to the virtual memory. Okay, because there are two layers apart. The CPU scheduler can interact with the hardware or it could interact with the IO channel, but not any other layers. So you can only talk to the layers. Layer I can only communicate with layers I minus 1 and I plus 1. Okay, that's the restriction of a layered organization. Okay. So the advantage of layered organization is more modular. Okay. If you change this component, it will only impact the component below it or above it and nothing else, because you don't directly talk to any other component in the system. So you only need to know what this component does and what this component does when you make a change to see if that change will impact either the layer below or the layer above. Okay. So it is more modular, simpler to and easier to design and debug. Okay. The disadvantage here is that this is more restricted in terms of communication. What if the CPU scheduler wanted to interact with the virtual memory manager? Okay. This organization will not allow you to do that. Okay. You have to then extend this interface to indirectly talk to the IO channel, which will talk to the virtual memory manager. Okay. So the disadvantage is that there is it limits communication across components. Okay? There's higher overhead of communication. There is extra copying and bookkeeping to be done. Okay? Every call has to go through several layers. Okay? So that means there's extra overhead. Okay? Nevertheless, although an operating system itself doesn't actually use a layered organization, there are components of the operating system that use the layered organization. In particular, the networking component of any OS uses this organization. Okay, so the TCP/IP stack that you may have heard of uses a layered organization where there is a physical layer and there's a MAC layer, which is your Ethernet layer, there's an IP layer, there's a TCP layer, and each layer can only talk to the layer below it or the layer above it. Okay? So the thing to take away is layer design has certain advantages. Okay? It's more modular than a monolithic kernel. And the other thing is, you don't see typically entire operating system kernels that are implemented in this fashion, but certain components of the kernel use this organization. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so the next organization is a microkernel architecture. Okay, so this is very different from what you see in the monolithic or Unix kernel. Okay, so in the microkernel architecture, operating system, you have a very small core component for the OS which is called a microkernel. This provides very low level features, and typically the feature it provides is communication. Okay? And practically every component that we have talked about that are part of the OS is implemented as user level processes. Okay? So you have your file system. Typically, you consider that to be part of the OS. It is part of the OS, except that it's implemented as a user process. Okay, there's a process that runs. Okay? You have a memory manager that's implemented as a user process. You have a schedule, CPU scheduler, user process. Network support, user process. Okay? So what you consider your kernel is something that is very small and very bare bone. All that it does is allows each of these components to efficiently communicate with other components. Okay. And practically all of these components of the OS, which does process management, memory management, file management, they are implemented as user level processes. They are systems processes, but they are implemented in the user space. And real applications then actually run as normal applications. Okay. So what are some advantages and disadvantages of a microkernel organization? Why implement an operating system in this fashion? Are there any advantages of doing this? Yes. It is restricted on space. In what way is space restricted? Memory, you mean? Okay, so if you have, but how does this reduce the amount of memory you use? All of the process.
You don't need all the system process, like you don't need network support or external.
Okay, that's true. So if you don't have a network card, you don't start that process. So you get a smaller footprint, OS footprint. So that's true. You can customize which components to run by not starting certain processes. Okay, that will give you a smaller footprint. That's true. What are some other things this then gives you? Okay, it is modular, right? It can't get any more modular than this. Where every component you just separate out and run it as essentially its own application. File system, as far as the kernel, this kernel is concerned, is an application. Okay. So if you want to change the file system, you just change that process. Nothing else has changed, really. Okay, so it is as modular as it gets. You want to replace the file system, just start another process that implements that interface. So it's easy to change the operating system because it's modular. You can just change a particular component which is its own user process. Okay. So highly modular. Okay. So this was primarily the reason why this architecture even arose, as the operating system monolithic kernels began to gain more and more functionality. It got harder and harder to maintain this large blob of code. I mean, these things became millions of lines of code. One process, you change something somewhere, there are 10 bugs that crop up. Okay? So to get around this problem, this was basically more of a software engineering attempt to redesign how kernels are implemented. Let's take each component, let's implement it as its own user's process. Okay? And then let the kernel, in this case called a microkernel, only provide very low level basic features which are these components have to interact to provide OS level services. So let's provide this communication interface which allows any systems process to communicate with any other systems process. Okay? Now it turns out that there are many let's just look at the next slide. So goal was minimize what goes into the kernel. So as I already said, advantages are better reliability, easier extension and so on. The disadvantage, why this actually never really took off. Okay, there were several operating systems that were designed using this architecture. There are some that are still in use today. I'll talk about them. Okay. But the reason this never really became popular was performance. So what about performance? Why does this architecture give you worse performance than a monolithic kernel? Yes.
Things in like different places, so you have to like communicate between processes.
Yeah. So the OS functionality is now separated out into user processes. So whenever any component here wants to talk to any other component, you have to communicate by sending a message. Okay. That has higher overhead than in monolithic kernel. In a monolithic kernel, if the let's say the file system or let's say the CPU scheduler wants to talk to the memory manager, you do this by invoking a function call. Okay. This is a single process, so you basically make a function call that goes from here to here, like in any process. Okay. That's very efficient. Here, if the CPU scheduler wants to talk to the memory manager, it has to send a message. This message is going to come to the microkernel, it's going to be sent back to the memory manager. Okay? That is lot more expensive, an order of magnitude more expensive than making a function call. Okay? As a result, the performance that you see on any microkernel based systems is going to be much worse than you will see in a monolithic kernel. Because in monolithic kernel, you can basically just make function calls from one component of the OS to another. Here they have to use messages. Okay, they send messages back and forth, which is much slower. Okay. So this is basically the big issue with microkernels. Okay, so there are many that have been built. Okay, so the first one was this system called Hydra, and then there are more modern ones called Chorus and Mach. Okay. So this is the most popular one that actually got some traction, but then you will see what happened. So it turns out that both Windows NT was actually derived from Mach. The very old versions of Windows NT actually took the Mach code base and built on it. And current Mach, current OS X is also built on Mach. Okay? So there are actually two very popular platforms today, which is Windows and Mac, that actually are derived from microkernel based architecture. So what happened though was, although they started from here, they saw that performance was bad. Okay, so they said, okay, let's see where performance matters and let's start putting these components back into the kernel. Because once you put something back into the kernel, they can talk using system calls rather than this. Okay. So you start with this and then you start putting things back into the kernel, you're essentially going back to the monolithic kernel architecture. Okay, so it's always a performance versus modularity trade-off between microkernels and monolithic kernels. Okay, so this is OS X. This is what OS X does. As I said, it's a hybrid architecture. So they took Mach. In fact, Mach is still used in OS X. If you actually go and look at the processes, you'll see the first thing that boots up is Mach. But then what they did is they took all of the stuff that's supposed to be in user space and put a lot back into the kernel, because in particular the BSD layer is part of the kernel, and there are still some things that run in user space, but not a whole lot. Okay, for performance reasons, a lot of things have gotten folded back into the OS. Okay, and NT went down the same route. Okay, in NT probably will not even see the presence of Mach, although here you do see. So let me just see if I can show you. Maybe not. I think it should be in system somewhere. to see. So if you actually go into the root directory of your Mac, you will see, okay, so you actually see the Mac kernel there. This is what boots up first, and then it starts loading things into the kernel, and then kernel actually is much more than your monolithic, rather your microkernel architecture. So the take home message is that because of performance reasons, all of this commercial platform, they basically like the idea of modularity, but because performance is always a important thing for users. If you have a very slow machine, you don't like it. You don't care what's in the OS. So they have to then think about performance, not just modularity. And that is why they make all of these trade-offs. Okay, so the last, so now that things have actually moved back to the monolithic kernel, it's not as bad as the picture I actually showed you. What most operating systems do is, although they are implemented as a monolithic kernel, they use this notion of modules to make the architecture simpler and easier to maintain. Okay. So module is essentially any component of the kernel that can be dynamically added or removed from the kernel. Okay. So your kernel is still one process. Okay. But the functionality can be dynamically extended by adding or removing modules. So you can implement OS functionality using the self-contained notion of a module. Okay. And then you can, when you boot up, you can load some modules, and at runtime you can actually load additional modules and extend what the OS can or cannot provide to you. Okay. So it is similar to layers, okay, but lot more flexible, because each layer, each module can talk to any other module. In layer, each layer can only talk to the layer above it or below it. So this is a modular architecture. So this is all the modules that, let's say, Solaris provides. Okay. So you have the core kernel that always runs when you boot up the machine, and then it loads additional modules. It can load certain file system modules, it can load certain scheduling classes, okay, it can load device drivers and whatnot. All of them are implemented as modules. Okay. So you, by only loading those modules that you need and no more, okay, you can keep the footprint small. And also by implementing implementing OS functionality as different modules, you can keep the architecture somewhat modular, although not as nice as the microkernel architecture, but it's still not bad. Okay, so just to give you another example of modules, so if you are on any, if you go to the Edge Lab next time, okay, so you can actually see what modules are. So if you type this lsmod command, so you will see, it will show you a list of all the modules that are implemented. So it will show you, these are all the modules that are currently loaded. There's a file system cache, your NFS is implemented as a module, there are various file systems, this is your networking module, which is IPv6. You will see that there are a whole bunch of them. So each of them is actually implemented as a separate component in Linux. Okay, so you can, and at boot time it loads a whole bunch of them. Here is the ext3 file system. Okay, and you can unload them at runtime. Okay, so you can actually use rmmod. You need to be root to do that, and you can unload a module. Okay, you can do insert module and add new modules and extend functionality all at runtime. So this gives you more modularity, better control over what functionality your OS is actually supporting at any given time. So that's basically a quick overview of what are the key components of an OS, okay, and what are different architectural choices that you can use when you implement your own kernel, going all the way from monolithic to layered to microkernel and modular. Okay. Most modern operating systems are modular. Okay, they implement OS functionality using modules. Okay, So the big design issue here is, how do you make OS efficient, reliable and extensible? Okay? And you will see that there's always a trade-off between efficiency and modularity. Okay? So you want to basically have a trade-off between simplicity and performance. Wherever possible, you want to keep things simple. Okay? You don't want to cram as much functionality as you want. But then, so for performance reasons, you can add certain functionality into the OS, rather than implementing them in user space as libraries. Okay, so that's basically a constant debate whenever you write any new operating system or extend any operating system. So what should be in the OS, what should be implemented as libraries, what should be modules, part of the core kernel and so on. Okay, so keep that in mind. So what we will do starting next time is take each of these components that we have been talking about and start looking at it in more detail, okay, starting with process management. Okay, so let's stop here. So there is a discussion section tomorrow, and as I said, there will be a homework that I'm going to hand out, which we will also discuss in the class tomorrow. Okay.